Welcome to the 69th episode of the Loose Threads podcast, a show about the rapidly changing consumer economy. This episode is brought to you by Loose Threads membership, which gives you actionable analysis, insights, and events that drive growth, and Loose Threads Espresso, your energizing and high-pressure filter for consumer news and context. We also have a newsletter that features the latest open letters to CEOs, podcasts with industry leaders, and news from Loose Threads. Check it all out at loosethreads.com. Joining me today is Rachel Blumenthal, the founder of Rockets of Awesome, a company creating modern children's clothes delivered conveniently for busy parents. Rachel started the company after running a previous business that made mothers' lives easier and has gone on to build a service that both mothers and their kids love.
The power dynamic has shifted. It's not mom saying, this is who I want you to be or who I think you are. It's a kid saying, this is my sweatshirt. This is who I want to be. This is my identity.
This is a particular challenge where the buyer and the user are two different people. Here's my talk with Rachel Blumenthal. Why don't we start, I guess, just talk a bit about your background and then we can work our way up to Rockets of Awesome existing.
So I started my career in luxury fashion at Yves Saint Laurent, and I was doing editorial placement and celebrity dressing. And it was that moment of Tom Ford and Stefano Pilati and really kind of everything you can imagine in sort of the fashion PR world. And it was amazing. And I was in this incredibly creative environment, but my role wasn't that creative. And I needed a creative outlet. So I went to the bead stores on Sixth Avenue in Manhattan and bought materials and made myself a ring and was wearing it at work one day. And the editors I worked with from Lucky Magazine saw it and decided to feature me as a designer. And when you're in that world and you know the smoke and mirrors, you just sort of play along with it. And it was funny. And about a month later, the editors from Daily Candy emailed and said, we want to feature you. What is your domain? And, you know, can we talk? And I said, sure. And let me get back to you on all of that. And I called a guy that I hadn't seen since I was 13 that I heard did websites. And he threw up a landing page with a photo and an email. And that was my domain. Daily Candy launched and we had hundreds of thousands of customers and buyers and editors that wanted this brand that didn't exist. And I just sort of ran with it. And it was a real, true, fake it till you make it moment. I literally had the one ring. I had never manufactured jewelry. I was not a trained jewelry designer, so on and so forth. But I thought that it was something that, you know, I could figure out. And so I started doing trunk shows at Henri Bendel. I was picked up as a third jewelry designer at Shopop and ultimately decided to leave my job, set up shop in my living room, and I figured I'd go back in 6 months when it didn't work out. And I built that brand over the course of 8 years. We were in about 500 retailers worldwide. We did private label for American Eagle, Target, J. Crew, and I licensed that business about 7 years ago.
Is it still going today?
It is not. Okay. The company that licensed it ultimately rolled the supply chain and the distribution into the other brands that they were running.
Okay. So that takes us to 7 years back, right?
Yes.
Talk us through from there.
Sure. So at that point, my husband was building a company called Warby Parker, and I was very deeply immersed in what him and his co-founders were doing and spending time thinking about the brand and the marketing strategy. And I would follow them to every single conference they would go to. And for the first time in a long time, I was really learning and expanding the way that I thought about businesses. We had also just had a baby. And so I was sort of like living and breathing that moment. And I was just fascinated with how technology could solve problems and all the innovation that was happening. And I would sit at a desk every day. I would try to come up with what I was going to do next. And I was just forcing it and forcing it. And nothing good comes of that. And I had no good ideas. But I would also talk about this experience that I'd had of being pregnant and trying to figure out what to buy and receiving endless Excel spreadsheets from friends of, you know, the Harvard Business Review of like what to buy when you have a baby. And I thought it was like the most insane thing I'd ever seen. They were color-coded and so on and so forth. And so I was like, this is crazy. Like, why isn't there a Cliff Notes version for what to buy? Everyone buys the same thing. And so I ultimately launched a business called Cricut Circle, which was Cliff Notes for what to buy when you have a baby. Three great products in every category, really rich editorial content, a very, very early algorithm to deliver personalized recommendations, and content and a brand that spoke to this generation of parents and the next generations of parents, and really tapped into an opportunity to connect with that customer and serve them. And as we were serving them and trying to figure out what our monetization strategy was, we were testing a number of different channels. And one of them was performing the best, which was this personal shopping service. This idea that we knew all these things about you. We could put the right products in your home right before you needed them and really be a service. It was performing really well, but we also were running into a number of challenges, one being that we didn't want to compete with the Amazons of the world on hard goods. The second being is that once parents built the confidence around the right stroller, the right car seat, they were sort of, you know, more confident and I've got this. I don't have to worry about it so much anymore and I don't need so many resources. But what was obvious to us is that kids are outgrowing their clothes. They're outgrowing them regularly. Every season, it is a need-driven purchase. And there was a tremendous opportunity to leverage the business model that was working, serve the customer that we were already speaking to in a new category. So that is really what inspired Rockets of Awesome. We ultimately pivoted the brand to become Rockets of Awesome because we knew that we needed to build a brand that spoke to parents and kids, boys and girls, and a pretty large age range of kids.
What was, I guess, the journey to realizing that you need to focus on both the buyer and the user and not kind of one or the other? Because that seems to be one of the unique things about how it's built.
The biggest challenges, both as what makes it so fun, but also makes it so hard, is that we have two customers. So we have the parents and the kids, and really understanding their psyche, the decision matrix, at which points are you speaking to who, and how do you deliver experiences to them is really, really challenging and really fun.
Did you know that was going to happen in the beginning, or was that a realization while building the company?
We knew that it was a thing. I don't think we appreciated the complexity of it. And we certainly didn't have a strong point of view yet of what that meant at each touch point. But as we would start to build out each touch point, whether it was the name, it was the design of the box, it was the packaging, it was the physical product, at each of those touch points, we were making very strategic decisions of who we were speaking to.
And so during the transition, when did it crystallize that, okay, this has to go into this brand? And like, did you ever feel it at any specific moment?
If anything, it was really driven by what does it mean to be an entrepreneur and what does it mean to be a leader and a CEO and somebody who's taken venture capital. It was one of those moments where, you know, to this day, I deeply believe in the mission that we were building at Cricut Circle. And I think that for the right business that has a supply chain, there's a tremendous opportunity there. It is still not filled in the market. So it was really one of those moments where you say, I still really believe in what we're building. But if I have to think about all of the people involved and all my constituents, the right decision is to go and do something else with all of our learnings.
Gotcha.
And the constituents were the driver. It was my team. It was my investors.
And so walk us, I guess, through the beginning of how do you go through that transition and like, how does the brand start to become?
Well, first sort of like shifting my mindset, you know, my head had been deep in the world of Cricut Circle. That was a community for moms. So a community of moms is very different than an apparel brand, service and a solution geared toward parents and kids. So it was taking some time to really immerse myself in, well, what does this mean? What does this mean to me? Why do I care about this? Why is this important to me? What are the experiences that I have as a parent that are inspiring me to be able to do this? And then once I was really able to articulate that both with words and with images, figuring out who were the team members and the experts that I could really leverage to be able to help build it. So the first thing that I did was hire early members of the team. First on the apparel design side of who are the children's wear design experts, and then on the brand building side of who are the creatives to be able to do this.
And so talk a bit about kind of where the children's market was from a product perspective, kind of when you started and what was maybe working, what you wanted to do differently, and then how that would kind of manifest.
Yeah, so the opportunity we saw for the business was twofold. One was that parents are the busiest of consumers, and you had all these innovations on all these great categories, but nobody was serving the busiest customer, being the parents. And so there was a tremendous opportunity to build a brand and a service that would resonate with them and serve them. And then the second being is that there's tons of kids' apparel brands. I would argue that maybe nobody needs another one. But what was frustrating, what we were hearing from customers, was that you couldn't find that trifecta of style and quality and value. You could get style and quality that was very expensive or vice versa. And so knowing how to build a supply chain, knowing manufacturing, I knew that we could be direct consumer and deliver that trifecta to our customer. And that was really important. It was, how do you deliver really high quality, really cool, stylish clothes at a very accessible price point and deliver it in a manner that made the customer's life easier?
One of the unique qualities of this market is, like, kids are growing really quickly. Do you see that as a challenge or opportunity or both? Or, like, how did you approach that reality of this market, as opposed to being like, if you're selling to older men, like, they have their size, they'll have that size forever. Generally, maybe they'll get a little bigger. It's a very different dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, in general, it's the greatest opportunity, particularly as a business owner, being a need-driven category. So kids are outgrowing their clothes weekly, monthly, definitely not yearly. So it's a great business there. But the challenge being that also kids' preferences change. So today she loves pink, and tomorrow it's the grossest color she's ever seen. And, like, how could you even consider sending her a pink shirt?
Right.
Both of those things really required us leaning on algorithms and building technology to be able to enable those algorithms. And really, the business, the core of everything we do, is driven by the data and the algorithms that we're building.
And so, do you know when their color preferences change, or, like, what does that mean to a level that you're willing to share?
Yeah, so we have enough indicators that enable us to build customer experiences. And what I mean by that is flows through the site, email messaging, and so forth, to be able to engage with the customer and make sure that our assumptions on changing preferences or changing sizes is accurate, and giving them the opportunity to communicate that to us as well.
How long were you working on it until it kind of launched or was publicly unveiled?
So we worked on it for 9 months before we launched it. Probably one of the harder areas was the fact that we were going to be an algorithm data driven business, but we had a cold start problem. We had no data whatsoever. We had, you know, this great community from Cricut Circle that we could lean on to capture anecdotes, but we didn't know who our customers were going to be, which meant that we were ordering blindly. We were buying into a full size range that we knew nothing about. We didn't know customer preferences. We didn't know if our customers would be young, on the young age or the older age. We also didn't know anything about how customers would think about our products in combination of each other in terms of outfitting or anything like that. So a lot of it was gut instinct, some knowledge of what customer preferences look like in the market compared to, you know, other kids' brands. And then we actually did this really cool thing, which is our engineering team built sort of an app that was mirrored after Tinder, but for outfits. And so we were actually teaching the algorithm in the very early stages which items go together to make great outfits to start to feed the algorithm.
And so, in your experience, do you find that the mom or the kid is easier or harder to please?
Both easy, both hard. Neither easy. It's about those touch points, right? And so when we launched the business, we were sending 12 items in a box. We were sending it blindly to your home, only based upon the first quiz questions and comments that you would give us. A lot of parents will share Facebook pages. We can see photos of the kids, but it was pretty blind and we had no data. And every time somebody keeps something or returns something, they're also giving us feedback, so we're getting smarter. But we've gotten much more sophisticated, where we have much more information. And we've since launched a number of digital product features to tailor the experience. So product was arriving in the home, all hell would break loose because, you know, you can't get in front of a kid opening a box, and the kids were keeping things they didn't need, or they were keeping everything. And, you know, parents were like, we love it all, but, like, we don't necessarily want to spend this much money out of the gate. And so we built a number of product features, one of them being a feature called Peek, which gives our customers a preview of what we send before we send it. And this was an incredible unlock for the parents and the kids, where it's primarily the mom using it, and she's able to control essentially what we deliver into the home. And this is good for two reasons. One is that she feels a little more engaged and doesn't feel like, you know, she's relinquishing all control, but we're doing the curation for her so she's not overwhelmed by it. And at the end of the day, mom knows if she needs, like, another pair of black leggings. The black leggings could fit perfectly into the profile and all the dynamics that say we should send them, but she might know that she just bought 5 pairs from somewhere else. And that way, when it arrives in the home, all hell can break loose and she feels like she's sort of, like, it's the
contained chaos.
Exactly, yeah. Chaos. But then what happens is really fascinating, which is that the boxes that we ship are truly tailored to the kids. No two boxes are the same. We have customers who their profile would tell you that they're quote unquote all boy, the sort of like assumptions around that you can make whatever they are, super athletic and so forth. But sometimes he wants to dress like a sister and wear a tutu, and we can serve all those preferences. And those are the really fun ones for us. And that box arrives in the home and the kid feels like, finally, mom didn't pick the items that go on the box. Somebody knows about me and cares about me, is listening. It's a rocket scientist, it's an expert, whatever they think it is. That is a moment where the kids really engage and feel like they have the ability to choose. The power dynamic has shifted. It's not mom saying, this is who I want you to be or who I think you are. It's a kid saying, this is my sweatshirt. This is who I want to be, what I think I am. This is my identity. And that shift in power dynamic is, in many ways, like a Jedi mind trick on both sides. They both feel like they won. But engaging the kid in a way that they're building their identity around the brand is really powerful for us. I've had parents that come up to me and tell me that we've actually changed their relationship with their children because they don't fight anymore. And we had this amazing, amazing story from a 10-year-old in Tennessee a couple weeks ago who told us that now that she gets Rockets of Awesome, she's not bullied anymore because she doesn't, quote unquote, have stupid clothes. And actually the lead bully and her are now friends because they both have Rockets and they're part of this like really cool club that they've created at school. You know, it sounds like something that you make up and it sounds like just one little story, but those are the powerful stories that make it worth it to us and make us want to continue to deliver these experiences.
What's like the trade-off or interaction between people driving the recommendations versus the data or the algorithms? Is it like a Stitch Fix like model where they're stylists? Is it purely more data? Like, how did it develop? And then I guess, where is it today?
It developed where it was very rules-based and it was very, very high touch to today when it is almost entirely algorithm-driven. That being said, there are sort of edge cases where we have a very trained team that jumps in and will support those hand-touch elements. But I think there are two nuances around a business like Stitch Fix versus ours, which is that, first of all, the precision around kids isn't as robust as women. We don't have to make them look skinnier. We don't have to make their butts look small. So there's less precision. But the second being is that the model is created so that we are a real solution for parents. We are orienting it around being for the savvy parent who has cracked the code in dressing their kids. They get the service, the solution, this great product, and it doesn't cost them more money. If anything, they're saving money. And having a stylist for their kids feels very frivolous. And so we really err away from that and enable the algorithm to be able to deliver this the experience.
So given that backbone, what sort of company do you consider this? Like, do you consider it a brand? Like,
we consider it a brand.
Okay.
So we are 100% a lifestyle brand that is powered by a vertical apparel label as well as technology and data science.
So talk about like how the launch went and what was the goal for you? And then like, what was the reality that developed?
Yeah. So you only get one chance to launch.
Do you think that's true?
I do.
There are like the Airbnb stories of like they launched like 19 times or whatever.
I think you have one chance to launch. That doesn't mean that you can't tell your story again or get a second chance, but the second, third, fourth chance, you always have the hurdles of the people that remember you from the first time. And so anything that you don't still stand for the first time is always going to be a hurdle that you're going to have to consider in your strategy. Mm-hmm. I also think that there is only one time to say, we've launched, we're here. This is the first time you're ever hearing about it. And so what that means is that it just gives you greater opportunities for press, really. And so for us, it was, how do we launch into a very noisy space, a very competitive space? How do we launch with a very strong point of view so people pay attention? And we also wanted to make sure that we weren't just considered another kids' clothing brand. For good or for bad, our instinct was that had connotations to it that wouldn't be taken that seriously. And we were more than that. And so we had a very strategic, multi-prong approach to our marketing strategy. It wasn't rocket science, right? It was press in lifestyle and fashion and tech and business and family. It was leveraging influencers and celebrities that were friends of the company. It was leveraging like-minded brands that we were friends with that had similar customer bases. It was a gifting strategy, partnerships, pretty much anywhere we could touch, right? And it was sexy and it was colorful and it was over the top and it was very aligned with who our brand was and consistent imagery and messaging and so forth. And it was awesome. It was so much fun. It was so exciting. We probably had 100 press stories around launch. It was really exciting. And, you know, I think a lot of that was driven by the fact that we had really built a brand and we had a strong point of view and a defined vision for what we were building. And there were so many elements to talk about because we were a tech company and we were a data-driven company and we were vertical and we were direct-to-consumer and all this sort of like sexy jargon. And we weren't the sexy jargon because we wanted to check the boxes. It was really core to where we thought the opportunity was.
And did you find that by and large people understood it?
We did. And I think that that was probably one of the bigger learnings that we've had over the last year and a half or so is that we haven't had to educate the consumer as much about the shopping behavior as we thought. In this day and age, customers are pretty familiar with personalization models, shopping services, subscriptions. I think we've had to educate around like why we are different and why we're not sort of a traditional subscription and how we're building a community around this customer that really hasn't been served.
And so I guess talk us through some of the developments up to the present, I guess.
We launched for back to school 2016. So back to school is basically our Christmas. And so really, really important for us. And
talk a little more about that in terms of what does that mean? And like, what's the activity that happens in that period?
Yeah. So back to school shopping is, you know, probably as you remember as a kid, right? The moment where it's like this big family activity where you go shopping and you're sort of stocking up for the year and the season. And I think it's really sort of a rite of passage for families also. It's a time where our customers are purchasing the most throughout the year. And they're really stocking up on the basics and getting the special items for like first day of school photos and so forth. So that's really fun for us. It is also a funny time because it starts in summer when people are at the beach on vacation at summer camp. Kids also go to school at different periods of time throughout the year based on where you are in the U.S. And so being able to hit that right is always challenging. But basically sometime in the middle of the July through September is our back to school season. So we launched with a bang in back to school. We had a very early response and sort of excitement around the brand, a lot of sort of attention. And we were growing really quickly. I think at the time we're like, oh my God, this is amazing. We have product market fit. This is great. Like, let's just keep cranking. And, you know, it was at that point where we realized that there were a number of elements to the foundation of the business that as a business, we really had to pause and hone in on and make sure that we were going to operate a profitable business and a healthy business before we kept growing. And so we really pulled back on a lot of the sexiness and the focus on growth last year to build a sustainable business. And that was very strategic for us. I think that you often find that you have startups that either go growth at all cost and we'll figure out the economics later, or you have the businesses that really pause and focus on the economics. And that was really important to us. And we built a number of digital product initiatives last year. We adjusted our product line, the customer experience to really make sure that we were serving the customer in an effective manner. And it was hard. It was super hard. We worked really hard. The team just killed themselves over it. And I think that's what makes it so gratifying to have hit the end of the year last year, 2017, in a greater position of performance than ever before, than we could have ever imagined, setting ourselves up for great success around growth this year. It's so gratifying for me watching the team be able to do that because it was tremendously hard and such a great accomplishment.
Yeah. So talk about some of those changes or developments that a lot of that energy went into and kind of why and I guess what they did for the business.
We launched a service fee, and that was really important for making sure that the customers that were coming in and trying our service had intent to purchase. The beauty of our brand is that it's really fun and looks exciting and I want to try it and that looks cool. But when we're paying for the shipping both directions and sending out product without our customers paying for it, that's really scary and very risky. And we needed to make sure that we could deliver the best experience to our customer, but it didn't have to be everybody. It could be the people that really wanted to purchase. And then delivering the feature called Peek, so giving people a preview of what we were going to send them, really enabled them more control and enabled us to be able to deliver a better assortment. And then we launched an incentive to keep everything in the box. And that really not only obviously drove up how much people were keeping and how they were shopping with us, but gave the customer reason to really engage more and make sure that what we were sending them were the right things for them. It was what they needed. It really helped us develop the data that we had so we could deliver better assortments, helped us learn more about the type of products that our customers really wanted to buy so that we can improve the actual physical product that we were creating, and it helped us to get to know our customers better and deliver a better experience to a more engaged customer.
Yeah. What was the evolution of kind of focusing on like the incentives in that? Because it's very kind of psychologically driven and so forth.
We're not a business of discounts, so we're never on sale. Right. But that doesn't mean that we don't want to give our customer who is highly engaged, who loves our business, who's an evangelist, great benefits, right? And it's really important for us that our product is at a very accessible price point and that we're delivering enough assortment that you can make great outfits with. And so for us, it was the toggles of all of those things and making sure the number of items in the box was enough, that you had enough choice, that you could make enough outfits that it could be a solution for you, that we could get the price point right, that it was very digestible and reasonable for what our customer looked like. Ultimately, our view was that if we were going to be a solution, ideally, the 8 items we sent you were the 8 items that you needed, that you wanted, so you would keep them. Because if they're not, then we're not really a solution yet. And finding that balance was sort of the magic for us.
Yeah. Talk a bit more about kind of price point in terms of, I guess, when you came in, how was the market kind of architected? And then how did you figure out where you wanted to sit in that paradigm?
We really looked at how do customers shop. If you look at parents who are shopping for their kids, we serve sizes 3 to 12, which is usually, you know, a 2.5-year-old to a 10-year-old. Parents are really looking for sort of the hack. Like, what is the hack? And the hack is you identify the 2 to 3 brands that you are going to shop for your kids almost indefinitely, basically until they have a strong enough opinion. And what are those 2 to 3 brands that are your go-to? It means that the style is right, the fit is right, the quality, and the price point. And our goal was always being one of those 2 to 3. How can we be in that sort of sweet spot so that you're always going to us and to serve you? And that meant that we wanted to really compete in the world of Old Navy, Gap, H&M, Zara, Children's Place, Justice, Abercrombie, Cat and Jack from Target.
Right.
And so that really helped us hone in on what the price point was. It was also really important for us that we could deliver better style and better quality than any of those retailers. And so what was that happy medium to be able to make sure that we were also, as a business, hitting good margin? And that helped us really hone in on where our price point was going to be. We're $16 to $38. Our average price point is $18. So it's a very competitive price point. Really, really exceptional quality and value that you're getting.
Talk more about kind of the quality need, because I feel like the surface level is like it's just kids' clothes. They can just be kind of cheap, but I feel like it's definitely the opposite.
It's a funny rub because it's just kids' clothes. They will rip the knee the minute they wear them. They will stain the shirt in the first art class they wear it to. And your quality can be the best thing in the world, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's ruined, right? And so in many ways, it's very disposable. But at the same time, parents want to feel like they're getting value. I want to feel like I'm getting value. And kids are very sensitive to fabrics. And so it's the importance of the high-quality fabrics that feel magical to the touch, the softest thing you've ever felt, stretchy, but at the same time, the perception of something being quality to parents means that it feels heavier. And heavy isn't necessarily right. Soft and stretchy. And so finding that balance in the fabrics that we work with to make sure that we can find that fine line of feels special, it feels different, it feels like it's going to last a decent amount of time, whatever that means to parents. It's usually several months, but it's soft enough with limited structure that kids want to wear it.
What's like the fit model process like?
So figuring out, like, what is our fit? What do we stand for? And, you know, we're definitely a slimmer fit, though our clothes are really, you know, we say that the price point in the style is for most. So for us, well, we have this really cool brand that resonates with urban customers. It also really resonates with customers in the middle of the country who are tuned into social media and tuned into just culture and don't have access to product, and making sure that the fit really served a wide range of customer while still having a point of view. And so we tend to fall between Gap and J.Crew, where Gap tends to be boxier. J.Crew tends to be super, super slim, and we fall right in the middle.
And then are there just like kids running around the office with the design team, or like how does that work?
Yeah, so we have fit models who come in. We also leverage our kids when our kids are a fit model size. Yeah. I think the hardest thing about kid fit models is that they grow.
Right.
And so the minute you find your fit model, right, they've grown. So it's really frustrating for us as a business.
Yeah.
But we also always have kids in more for testing out like comfort and wear testing, as well as giving us feedback on product.
Yeah, I feel like you could run like a daycare. As
we
like
basically
a...
do, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But it's the best part. Like when right. the kids are in our office, that is the spirit and the energy of why we exist.
Right. So a lot of the companies you mentioned before are very much retail-based competitors. How did you, I guess, think about both the opportunity and the challenge, knowing that I'm sure parents are often out and about and kind of know those places and frequent them? And when or what does it look like for this brand to exist offline as well?
You know, we really started with the fact that so much of the purchasing was really moving towards online, and parents are busy, and so they need to be able to transact on their phones or on their computers. And nobody wants to be dragging their kids to the mall because it's a nightmare and it's meltdown central. And so how did we deliver experience that mirrored the existing behavior, but do it in a way that was a better experience? And that was first putting the product in the home. So the idea that we go shopping for you, we put it in your home, and you can shop from the comfort of your home. You can also text us. And for our members, you have an e-commerce experience where you can purchase a la carte between boxes whenever you want. That being said, I really believe that the future of retail and commerce is meeting your customer where they want to be met. And so the critical importance of understanding who your customer is and how they want to engage and how they want to purchase. For our brand, I do think that there is a brick and mortar experience there. I think it's much more interactive than just racks of clothes.
Right.
But we also know, and we've learned selling our clothes to our customers, that the clothes are insane. Like, they are the most incredible quality, and they are what customers fall in love with and what retain our customers and why they keep coming back for more. And so beyond what does commerce and what does retail and purchasing look like for our customer, more now than ever, we just want to get our product physically in front of people to touch it. Because when they touch it, they melt and they freak out and they buy it and they retain with us. And so thinking about, can we get it into more homes? Can we get our customers into experiential retail? It is something that we are very actively working on, something that we're really excited about, because we've always had a strong point of view on what that will be. And it won't be, you know, the modern day Gap.
Given the busyness of this customer and kind of all the fragmented places that moms spend their time and attention, what have been some of the marketing things you all have done to try and stand out or build that affinity or grab that attention in ways that are different from the rest?
Yeah, I'd say the customer experience that we control end to end has been core to that. Every single customer that writes a review talks about some of the touch points of the customer experience. So from how easy it is to onboard, the box is just really special. It has a handle, so it's easy to carry into your house. You don't need a knife or a scissor to open it. It has the return label and the return bag. And our customer experience team is like the superheroes of the company. Everybody falls in love with them and like wants to be their best friend. So I think the end-to-end customer experience is just really special and really magical. And that creates the early evangelism. But the clothes really do overtime for us. They are what kids build their identity around. They're choosing in their dress over other brands. And it's this really happy medium between colorful and comfortable and the graphics that kids respond to, but polished and sophisticated enough that the parents say, like, all right, you're wearing like athletic shorts, but like you actually look kind of cool. And like, I feel good with the way that you look. And that was like a really hard nut to crack, and one that I don't think most brands have been able to do at an accessible price point, something that we're really proud of. We definitely do a lot on the social channels, whether it be Facebook or Instagram, via email, text message, anywhere that we can sort of tap into where moms and kids are ready, primarily moms, and how do we inspire them?
What's been the cheapest and most expensive lesson you've learned building the company?
The cheapest in the big scheme of things has been the investment we made in the brand. I think a lot.
Meaning like the fuzzy brand.
The fuzzy, the visuals, the messaging, the fuzzy way that we make you feel, the magic that we make you feel. It's so intangible, and it feels funny to kind of say that that is value, but it is the greatest value that a business ever builds, and one that I wholeheartedly believe is worth investing in, and one that just pays back again and again. The most expensive is probably, we made a brand video in the beginning that has never really seen the light of day. And it was one of those moments where we had such a big vision and we had no budget, and nothing good comes of like trying to make those two things work in like creating content.
Especially visually.
It was very cool. It just like, video is really hard. And if you're just the slightest bit off, it doesn't work. Thankfully, we've been able to sort of like resurrect pieces of it, but the end-to-end vision of it really never came to be the way we wanted it to.
So we talked before about kind of taking last year to really focus on the economics and kind of make sure ducks were in a row, so to speak. As you look, I guess, to the future, what keeps you up at night from the business perspective? And what do you think could go wrong that, you know, will take effort and intention to mitigate against?
You know, for us, we're super focused on growth right now, now that the performance of the business is in a really, really solid place. And you know, what I'm constantly thinking about is how do we build this business and how do we build this brand to get to the middle of the country as quickly as possible? Those customers are the holy grail to me, and we try to learn so much from them. In many ways, while I grew up on Cape Cod and it is coastal, it's a very similar customer. What is the balance of building marketing strategies that speak to the coasts and continue to build aspiration while really speaking to your core customer? And I think that that's a tough nut to crack. We'll always look at how do we continue to build the supply chain to be more flexible, because, you know, we're still designing many seasons out and we have data every single day that we can react to. So how do we build that to be more flexible? And how do we build our data richer and richer and smarter to be able to drive those decisions?
Yeah. It's interesting, I guess, talking, because there are certain parts of this where it sounds like you partially run, at least on the back end, like a fast fashion-like business, like trends still exist and so forth. But it sounds like there's still opportunities or wishes even that the lead times would slowly compress and compress.
I mean, they can always be faster, right? Like, we are way faster than traditional vertical brands, but we'll never be fast enough. I think we're starting to figure out some of those tactics to give us as much flexibility as possible. And it's really fun to be able to see and to be able to get into some of those tactics. But, you know, I think until we're running and operating our own manufacturing plant, we'll never have the level of flexibility and control that we want.
It sounds like, and maybe even from the beginning, that you had a very clear definition of, you said 2, 2.5 to 10 was kind of the age range. How do you both think about and then actually focus on that? Because on the one hand, it would seem amazing to own that section. On the other hand, I'm sure at some point in the back of your mind, you're always like, well, they're always growing and growing and growing. And like, how far can you push this affinity from an age and kind of residence perspective? And so how does that get debated or thought about from your side?
Well, even ages 2 to 10 is such a broad age range, and so much changes and so much happens in that range, and taste levels and preferences and cultural references and who the customer is, mom versus kids. We very much geared our focus and our strategies to the older kid. We think about the 8-year-old with the idea that if it is cool enough for the 8 and 10-year-old, it'll be appropriate and cool for the younger kid. I think what we've seen, because we've been successful there, is that now the parents of the 12-year-olds are like, can you please do juniors? Right. Like, junior market is rough, and can you please fix it?
Is it the same problems or different?
It's slightly different in that juniors, like, you know, the kids want to be more sophisticated right. than their parents are comfortable with them being. And they're sort of somewhere between kids market and adult market, and both the fit as well as the aesthetic is not necessarily appropriate. So there's opportunity there, but it is such a tiny, tiny, tiny segment that we don't look at that as a massive opportunity. Mm. We actually think much more about how do you get in front of the mom before she's making her buying decisions for her children, and can you start younger with her? And I always say mom because we're 97% moms. We certainly have some dads, and we wish that we had more. But, you know, how do we start to build that relationship? Whether we're selling at that age or we're just creating content at that age where we can engage her so that she knows where her brand when the time is right.
How much does that then overlap with parenting itself?
A ton. And, you know, I think that such a broad age range, there's so many different topics around parenting that that age range is thinking about and engaged with, which makes it hard to create content because you're sort of all over the map. And so we have to be really focused on like, where do we lean in? And we tend to lean into going back to our core mission of being a service and a solution. So more service solution, life hack oriented mm-hmm. than sort of like the broad content space. But thinking about also that, you know, appealing to mom, she is smart, she's educated, she's savvy. She's the same consumer that she was before she got pregnant, and all of a sudden people put like the mom stamp on her, right? And so how do we just engage her and talk to her? And I think that that's been a fortunate unlock for us because we are that customer and we were pissed that nobody was talking to us.
Yeah. And it also brings you back full circle to the original business exactly. in a way, right?
Yeah.
Was there any point where you almost walked away from the company or was like, I don't want to keep pushing this farther?
Hell no. I am like the biggest fighter you will ever meet. And everybody will tell me no. And they will tell me like, you're crazy and this can never work. And you're like, the party's over. You're running out of time. And I'll be like, get out of my way. I'm going to that goal over there. And like, if you're not on the boat with me, then like, get off. I'm very goal oriented and will like fight and fight and fight. At the same time, I wouldn't describe myself as competitive, which is strange, but I'm like a very team-oriented person who like likes to rally the troops and like get everyone going to the same goal.
Is there any doubt ever?
There's always doubt, but there's so much naivete that it sort of like clouts the doubt because yeah. I often don't know enough. So I'm in many ways like really powerful. And I think that naivete enables me to continue to take these risks and not be afraid.
And so as you look forward, I guess, what's on the horizon? What are you most excited about? And where do you want this to be in like 3 to 5 years?
So in 3 to 5 years, we want to be one of those 2 to 3 brands that mom is going to. We want to be a household brand that's really a brand that families are rallying around that stands for more than just selling clothes. We have a big, big campaign that we're launching for back to school that we're very excited about. And really, you know, that go-to brand for services and solutions and just like amazing, amazing product. I imagine over time that product line will evolve. It'll grow. The way that we talk to our customers and really dimensionalize the experience will change. We'll be able to deliver different retail experiences along the way. And today, our focus is really continuing to listen to our customer, listening to our customer, engaging with our customer, literally on the phone, via email, via focus groups, is what has driven all of our awareness of all of the things that we have changed and evolved and grown. And they're our eyes and ears.
Awesome. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Loose Threads podcast. You can read full transcripts of the podcast and join the newsletter at loosethreads.com. Also, feel free to leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. Thanks to George Drake Jr. for editing this episode. We have a great roster of upcoming guests, including Fran Dunaway of Tomboy X, Tony King of King & Partners, and Eleanor Turner of Argent. Thanks for listening and talk to you soon.